We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 219, and we've got a real special inside look in the law for you today, because we are going to do a live deposition. Mr. Torres, what did you know and when did you know it? It's all over the news that clearly you tampered with the results of Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. Now, get your story straight. Have you produced any calendars showing what when you might have done that or when you might not have done that?
Yeah, I have this calendar from 1982 that shows...
Did you or did you not ask the Wiki team to cover your tracks, sir? Yes or no? Is the mod squad involved? How deep does this go?
I choose to plead the Fifth Amendment on the grounds that anything I say may tend to incriminate me.
Can he do that? Andrew, can you do that? Yeah, I need to consult my
attorney. Stay tuned for the C segment in which we break down whether I can do that or not. No, I suppose we should actually let our listeners in on this inside joke.
Well, they apparently knew because it was in Future Andrew last episode. So apparently you must have tried to get ahead of it. Again, I don't know how deep this conspiracy goes, but Brian must be in on it because he lets you put in a little trying to get out ahead of the news. Andrew has tampered with the results. He's tried to deduct me one point, and now I'm actually one question ahead of where we thought I was for Thomas Takes the Bar Exam. And, of course, there's some other stuff in the news we might cover today. But, I mean, I imagine this is going to take the bulk of the time.
Yeah, that is. We've got 57 minutes on TTTBE Gate. We've got 2 minutes on baseball law. And then you know, some stuff happened this week.
Yeah, so I also hired an assistant to ask you the questions and shield me from any sort of blame for what I might ask you. No. All right. We'll get back to that. I'm going to prepare. Tell you what. Do you want to testify in writing? We'll do that. We'll do like the Mueller deal with Trump.
Yeah, I'll submit my answers in writing, not under oath. Yes.
Let me assure you, listeners, we will get to the bottom of it. I mean, this is going to be, but as we saw with Watergate and with Trump, I mean, it could take years before we see any sort of results. But don't worry. We'll maybe nominate yourself if you want to be, you know, independent counsel for the TTP Gate investigation.
I hope Opening Arguments go to lawyer for things like this. So,
all right. So what are we really talking about today, Andrew?
So first, I just want to flag, we're going to handle this as soon as the information comes out. But we did episode 202 with the Cybabe, where we talked about the $289 million verdict against Monsanto in connection with Roundup. Monsanto's new parent company, Bayer, the aspirin people, they bought Monsanto back in July. They moved for reconsideration and to set aside the verdict. And the trial court judge has indicated that she is favorably inclined to set aside the verdict. She will issue her full formal rulings on Monday, October 22nd, of course. So we'll be keeping an eye out for that. And as soon as that comes in, we will go back and revisit. You may recall that I expressed some skepticism on whether the entirety of the verdict was going to stand up on appeal. One of the things that I think is was key to that analysis was that you don't get to appeal the facts, right? You're sort of stuck with the factual determinations made by the jury. In a motion for reconsideration or to set aside at the trial court level, you can dispute the facts. And that's what's happening. Trial court judges signaled that she's positively inclined to reconsider and set aside some or all of the verdict. We'll keep our eye on.
All right. This just in, I'm getting word there was a meeting between Mr. Torres and Brian at Brian's house, ostensibly to discuss the use of clown horns in the show. But I'm getting word from an inside source that it actually was about the cover. No, okay. What else are we talking about?
The Ziegenhagen dossier, I emphatically deny. And that's a preview for next week. We are going to talk about... Oh, my gosh. Thomas, I have to tell you, Carter Page may be my new favorite crazy person human being.
Oh, yes.
I am so excited to cover that, but we're going to do it on Tuesday.
Now, never mind the fact that we were originally tipped off by some opposition research by a rival podcast. It doesn't matter. Ultimately, the facts were... All right. No, in seriousness, we're also going to talk about this Harvard admissions lawsuit, affirmative action back in the news, and given that the court is what it is... I can't imagine that's going to be good news, but we'll see. And then we've got some, I love this. We've got an Andrew was wrong and we've got an Andrew was right in the same segment. And I think they're both pretty significant. That's going to be fun to talk about. Of course, Andrew was also a crook in how he handled the scoring of the exam, but that's a different segment. So let's get to it. What do you think?
I love that this is the most passionate you have ever been about the law.
I know. I've been going through a LexisNexis all night looking for bar exam game violation. I can't find anything. I don't know the syntax to search through the database or what, but I'm going to find, I'll uncover something.
Yeah, it's all about the Boolean operators. That's the key.
Listener Thomas asks, can you be pardoned for a podcast crime? Where does the podcast crime court? No, all right, let's get to the real news once again. All right. Okay, so affirmative action. You know what? I just want to remind people, if they're newer listeners too, that Andrew has done a lot of great content on this in the past, and I was blown away by how much misinformation there is about affirmative action. And I think, in my humble opinion, it's largely due to white fragility and overreaction to these things. So check those out. Looks like it's episode 93, so it's been a while, but well worth listening to if you want to hear more about that. But what's in the news lately regarding affirmative action?
Yeah, this is a case that went to trial starting yesterday. So interestingly enough, like when we typically cover affirmative action, we think about it from the status of the law being in flux. And so you think about, you know, as you flagged in this case, what is the newly minted Supreme Court going to do? This case is years away from the Supreme Court. Is a trial that is going on right now. It is based on a lawsuit that was filed in 2014, and it was filed by a group called Students for Fairness in Admissions. That is a front group for a conservative activist named Edward Blum. And Edward Blum, in fact, has been financing lawsuits against college admission practices for over a decade. He was the guy that financed the plaintiff in the 2016 Fisher case that we discussed in episode 93 that you plugged in the intro, right? So this is his hobby horse. His hobby horse is ending diversity in college admissions. And he has a very clever strategy that he has used against Harvard here that
it involves Asian people, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
Okay.
Here are the kind of the facts of the argument, right? Asian Americans are roughly 5.5% of the U.S. population, and they are between 17% and 23% of Harvard admissions. They are 22.2% of students who were accepted into the class of 2022. That is incoming freshmen at Harvard this year. So you kind of look at that on face and you say, okay, they appear to be four times more overrepresented from the population. Where's the problem? And the problem, I'm going to link the complaint. It is an exceptionally lengthy complaint, but it's really, really interesting. I'm going to quote from paragraph 218 of the complaint, which says that in compiling publicly available data, that Asian Americans tend to be far more overrepresented at the high end of objective admissions criteria than even a 22.5% admissions rate into Harvard, which, by the way, making up 22.5% of the population at Harvard is a pretty good result. But here's what the data say, that 46% of domestic Harvard score senders with SAT scores above 2200, that's on the 2400 scale, were Asian American. 55% above 2300 were Asian American. And they're continued more of that. So the argument is, if you are just taking individuals on the basis of test scores, if you were doing it in a random way from otherwise qualified pool of applicants, you would expect perhaps double the rate of Asian Americans at Harvard than currently exists. Now, I should
you're
put
saying it would be like almost half Asian Americans.
Yeah.
Wow.
If 46 to 55% of the highest test taker right out of 2,400 to get a 2,300 is
quite,
you know,
good.
Less than one half of 1% of the population, right? And of that subgroup, basically half are Asian American.
Wow.
So that's kind of the base of the area, and you can see how it has that really intuitive pull at you. I should mention again, as we're talking about this group, that the Trump administration filed a motion to intervene in this trial back in April of 2018. That motion to intervene was denied, but it was noteworthy that the Trump motion to intervene was taken directly from an SFFA letter, right? So in other words, this guy is seriously close to Donald Trump. Keep that in the back of your mind. What's the basis for the lawsuit? It is a lawsuit under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which bars discrimination at private institutions that receive federal funds, which Harvard is, right? They're a private school. They receive federal funds. Therefore, they're subject to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That prohibits, as you know, classifications of citizens solely on the basis of race, which are described as, by their very nature, odious to a free people whose institutions are founded upon the doctrine of equality. They threaten to stigmatize individuals by reason of their membership in a racial group and to incite racial hostility. That's a separate Supreme Court opinion interpreting the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So obviously, then the question is, what counts as classifications on the basis of race? Right. And here I'm really glad you previewed our prior episode 93, because the way in which this debate is framed by the other side is framed as, oh, quotas, right? Like, you admit 100 people to Harvard. And so, you know, you look at it and go, OK, well, five of them are going to be African-American and five are going to be Asian. And, you know, and you sort of go through and assign slots on the basis of membership in an ethnic group. That is not the law and has not been the law for more than 40 years, right? There are no
quota
systems.
It was the law at some point?
It was never quite, well.
Are you saying like so, it's explicitly not been the law for 40 years is what you're saying? Like,
it has explicitly not been the law, but let's describe, right? That case was a case called Backe versus the Regents of the University of California. And it involved Alan Backe, who was a white male, who applied to the medical school for the University of California at Davis. And he was rejected twice. And the evidence showed that each year what the medical school did was they accepted 100 students, and they reserved 16 of those 100 spots exclusively for minority candidates. So in other words, whites were competing for one of 84 spots. Minorities were competing for at least 16 of 100 spots, right? There's nothing that prevented a minority candidate from being admitted in the general pool, but there was a certain reserved number set aside for only for minority candidates. Now, again, not in any way broken down like I described the quota system, but something that the way in which things were fought at the Supreme Court level is they were fought on the question of, okay, well, it's not an explicit quota, but this seems pretty close to one, right? And having 16 diversity seats set aside seemed, quote, pretty close to one. And so ever since then, the analogy, that's been the analogy in the background. How much does this seem like a set aside that is based on race? And does that mean it is, quote, and remember, that's the prohibition in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, prohibitions solely on the basis of race, right? That's the standard. And so so that's kind of the baseline. We talked about the Fisher case, in which the University of Texas uses race as a factor of a factor. And go back, listen to that episode for all of the specific details. It's very clearly attenuated. It is not, it is in no way matching up to sort of the quota system. That was a 5-4 decision. It was authored by Anthony Kennedy. We're going to talk about Kennedy's kind of interesting views on race in college admissions in this segment. But Kennedy has been replaced by Kavanaugh, and I am 100% positive that Brett Kavanaugh does not have nuanced views on racial admissions.
Oh, he is very much Irish people were slaves too kind of guy. I get that vibe.
Yeah. 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 So do I. Look, Fisher is going to be revisited. We're going to talk about that. It may be revisited in this case. Why don't we talk a little bit about what Harvard actually does?
All right.
Because I was kind of surprised.
Too bad we
by
don't
this,
know and... anybody who knows is in any way affiliated with Harvard or has any. Can we get Ted Cruz? No, we can't.
Yeah. Oh, well, I try. I really, really wanted to get Ted Cruz on the show, but he could not be reached for comment. He was his press staff wrote back that said he's too busy fending off the provably false claims that he's shorter than Beto O'Rourke.
So, getting his ass handed to him in debates over and over. Sorry. OK, let's get. Yeah. So what's going on in Harvard? How do they do it?
So let me cut to the chase, which is. This is paragraph 198 of the complaint, which says Harvard does not reveal publicly any aspect of its deliberative or decisional admissions process other than the end result. So that's why we're having a trial right now. That's why we're accumulating information, because unlike UT Austin, where we went through in the Davis case, specifically how they compute the scores, Harvard doesn't release that.
Well, see, that I don't think that's something we would accept if it were the other way. Like if a school is just a public school is only letting in white people and we're like, how are you making this calculation? We can't tell you. No looking. No peaks.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And look, like they are going to be required to divulge the process. Here's what we do know. And again, these are the numbered paragraphs from the complaint. They begin at 189. This is how Harvard goes through the process. So admissions officers start by assessing each applicant in four areas: academics, extracurriculars, personal qualities, and athletics. Okay, and those kids get rated from 1 to 6 in each of those four areas. If they pass the initial ranking, so I guess if you are, you know, all sixes, or who knows, maybe if you're all threes, right? I mean, it's Harvard. But if you pass that rating, you get moved on for further evaluation. So they do this kind of first cut because they get 40,000 applications. And then the rest get a standard rejection letter, right? And sometimes there are notes in the rejection file that says a case is below the edge or case falls flat. As the parent of a 16-year-old who was already starting to think about where he wants to apply to college, like that was a little disheartening to think that someday his application may wind up in a folder that says case falls flat. But there you go.
I've seen Ted Cruz play basketball. I refuse to believe that athletics is any major consideration. So is that just like a bonus or something? Because it doesn't. It seems weird that that's such a primary category.
I don't think. Right. Those are the four areas that they evaluate. Again, having spent a lot of time at Harvard and
or maybe it's like they make sure you can't play sports. They're like, we can't have any.
I didn't meet a whole lot of ones. I will just say that. I remember throwing around the baseball on the Harvard quad, and there were not a lot of ones in my class. Let me say it that way. No, look, there's nothing that says, and I would be stunned if those four criteria were weighed equally, right? Like those are the four buckets that things fall into. And obviously, I think academics is highly weighted, extracurriculars, somewhat weight, personal qualities, somewhat weight, athletics, somewhat weight, right? So, there certainly doesn't seem to be anything to suggest that, that you know, it's, you're like, well, I only had a 710 on my SATs, but I'm really, really good at basketball.
That's my 100-yard dash is going to get me into Harvard.
Yeah, right. So, okay, you pass the initial screening, right? And then you get passed on to readers, right? And the readers, there's a big body, and then, you know, each individual gets a whole swath of applications. And you get three readers see your application. So no one person can tank you up or down. And then the admissions committee convenes to discuss everybody who's been through three separate readers. That is between 5,000 and 7,000 applicants. And then those go to the full committee meeting, in which the 35 admissions officers debate and vote on every single application. And they vote by majority ballot. So, you know, you could be the person who got in 18 to 17.
We saw a documentary of this in Legally Blonde, the documentary about how the admissions were. If you send in a video involving a bathing suit, I think you have a good chance.
You can send in a separate video now. Oh, my gosh. I was going to mention that you cut to the punchline, but you can send in a video. You can send in like your artist portfolio. You can send in other stuff. So apparently Legally Blonde was prescient. The Harvard Admissions Committee looked at that and then said, yeah, let's do that. That seems to be the right way to go about this.
Yeah, we've been missing out on a chance to watch people's audition tapes. Wait,
I just got an idea for a fabulous new reality show. we're going to talk about this offline.
But, yeah.
It's going to be like episode one of American Idol, only it's going to be, you know, the Harvard Admissions Committee laughing about. Anyway, up or down vote. You need 18 votes out of 35 to get in. And this was the part that, like, it reduced me almost to tears. The complaint says, typically, more students are voted in than space will permit. So the final portion of the process is spent in reruns in which candidates who had won approval have their initial acceptances rescinded.
Wow.
After reruns, a final decision is made to accept, reject, waitlist, or Z-list the applicant. I'll get to Z-listing in a minute, but you can pass the committee, and then they go back and go, sorry, we're going to have to vote out the ones that, you know, people were the closest on the fence over. That's rough. Applicants who are waitlisted are reviewed again after the admissions office has received their updated grades, test scores, and achievements. Those placed on the Z list are admitted on the condition that they take a mandatory year off before enrolling in Harvard. By the way, I was Z listed at Yale Law School. I did not know that there was a thing for that, but that was a thing. But the complaint, I think intriguingly, says Harvard uses the Z list to admit legacies and children of affluent families and elite schools who cannot gain admission through the ordinary course. That absolutely did not describe my application As I've said on the show, my parents did not complete college. They are not wealthy donors to Yale Law School. So there's nothing. It's a complaint, right? It's just a paragraph of an allegation. There's nothing to back that up. I'll be really intrigued about this sort of Z-list policy as it comes out, because I'd never heard of that before. So there we go. That's the Harvard process. If Harvard does not engage in substantive discussions about how the readers score the application and how that vote takes place, you might ask yourself, well, then what are the bases for the allegation in the complaint? And the basis for the allegation, I think there are four different claims, but I think all of this really comes down to the allegation that's put forward in paragraph 5. And paragraph 5 says this: each year, Harvard admits and enrolls essentially the same percentage of African Americans, Hispanics, whites, and Asian Americans, even though the application rates and qualifications of each racial group has undergone significant changes over time. This is not the coincidental byproduct of an admission system that treats each applicant as an individual. Indeed, the statistical evidence shows that Harvard modulates its racial admissions preference whenever there is an unanticipated change in the yield rate of a particular racial group in the prior year. Harvard's remarkably stable admissions and enrollment figures over time are the deliberate result of systematic, intentional racial discrimination designed to achieve a predetermined racial balance of its student body. In my view, that's the linchpin upon which this entire lawsuit is going to hinge, right? If it is demonstrated that Harvard engages in systematic rejiggering of how it admits applicants so that it reaches certain numbers and that those numbers stay consistent from year to year, that's going to be, I think, a really, really difficult sell in front of a jury that says that in terms of whatever the instructions from the judge are with respect to fact finding, they're going to say something is solely on the basis of race if and then they're going to cite from the Fisher decision or some other equivalent if it seems analogous to a quota system. And if, you know, out of every 100 spots, it looks like, you know, 5 go here and 10 go here and 15 go here, then I think Harvard is going to lose at trial. I want to be very, very clear here. There's a giant if at the beginning of the statement, right? I am repeating an allegation from a complaint in a trial that is one day old. We do not know what those numbers look like longitudinally over time. We do know, for example, just the Asian American admissions rate has gone from 17 to 22 over the past 5 years, right? So it those facts tend to undercut that allegation. But in my view, that's the key allegation in this lawsuit.
Wow.
Hey, you guys know that my law practice is dedicated to helping entrepreneurs, small businesses, the kinds of people who tend to hire people. And that's why I'm always excited when we get ZipRecruiter on as a sponsor. ZipRecruiter built a better online job portal. Instead of just posting a job and hoping the right candidate comes along, the ZipRecruiter platform actually learns what you're looking for, identifies candidates with the right experience, and goes out and invites them to apply for your job. That's why, and I know you know the statistic, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter finds good candidates and sends them to you. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. And as I said in the intro, I'm really excited because OA listeners who are small businesses, businesses of any size, I know you're out there. You guys send me emails. You can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just head on over ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter.com/OA. Post your job. Try it for free. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire.
Yeah, I guess so. According to the law, it sounds like it should be that Harvard is half Asian Americans? Or is it, how much is it going to allow for, you know, like what's the leeway in that? If they have some methodology that, you know, like it is going to not violate that law, what is it going to look like?
Yeah. And that's the exactly right question. And so to answer that, we have to go back to what happened in Fisher. Okay. And what happened in Fisher was, as I said, that this was a Kennedy decision. Fisher was hailed as a victory for affirmative action when it came out in 2016. And as we said in episode 93, it is a tenuous or Pyrrhic victory at best, right? And the reason comes from essentially two things, right? The first has to do with, and both have to do with the fact that it was an Anthony Kennedy opinion, okay? After Bakke, the general consensus coming out of the Powell concurrence in that case was that a college or university can consider the concept that we see in the social science literature of critical mass, right? And I'm going to link an article in the show notes because I am 100% a believer in this literature. So in the Bakke decision, that was 1978, Lewis Powell wrote a separate concurring opinion, which justified the use of some consideration of an applicant's race and background, and justified that by shifting the focus from remedying the effects of past discrimination, right? Which, by the way, that was sort of the civil rights 1.0, right? That's Lyndon Johnson's famous foot race metaphor. You have been specifically held back, and therefore it doesn't make sense to hobble you in chains and then be like, well, why don't you and this white guy start at the same line? No. Okay. You get to start, you know, just like in the foot race, those who were further out on the track start further up on the lines because they have further to run. That was the analogy that was used. In the late 70s, you saw a white backlash propelled by Richard Nixon and then Ronald Reagan against that metaphor.
Right, because said, sure, no, there was look, hundreds let's... of years of slavery and then Jim Crow and then, you know, just fundamentally, systematically holding black people back. But, you know, there was like 3 years of maybe somebody got into college. So call it even. So there's a white backlash to that.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. And so in order to respond to that, academics and the literature and the court began looking for alternative justifications, because you would poll people and you would say, among groups that have been historically discriminated against, does it make sense to give them an additional preference to remedy for the effects of past discrimination? And that would poll 60-40, 65-35 the other way, right? People would say kind of consistently, no, we don't think that's good enough. Obviously, I disagree with that, but that was the reality. And you started seeing social science literature that provided alternative justifications. I am going to link the Etkowitz et al. Article because this is one of the first ones I remember reading. It's a 1994 article, I believe, on the underrepresentation of women in the hard sciences, right? But again, the same kind of critical mass analogy is applicable here as is applicable in the science field. Etzkowitz says, a minority group, especially one that has been traditionally discriminated against, is easily marginalized when only a small presence in a larger population. Its continued presence and survival is in constant jeopardy and requires outside intervention and assistance to prevent extinction. As the group's presence and level of participation grows, as it reaches this critical mass, and now I'm paraphrasing, that group then can self-organize. It can fend for itself in academic dialogue. It can be a robust part of the community and a part of the deliberative process. And we've talked about this before. So number one, you can only imagine kind of the social aspect of being the only woman in your science class at a university or being the only black kid in your class of 200, right? Like that So there is a socialization component of critical mass. But there is also a discursive deliberative, right? The essence of education, the idea that if you've got a white teacher and a bunch of white kids and they express a predominantly white, culturally biased opinion, and one kid pipes up to go, that seems weird. Number one, they might not pipe up if they're the only one in the class. They might, you know, think, oh, I guess it's me that's wrong on that. I mean, 99 people, you know, all seem to agree that I'm wrong. And number two, it's easier to dismiss and kind of marginalize that experience and that perspective. And so we are talking fundamentally about education policy here. Certainly seems to make all the sense in the world to me to say, if we truly value education, then we want to have a diversity of viewpoints. And if a diversity of viewpoints is based upon the candidate's background and racial background, then we want to make sure that we're not just engaging in tokenism, right? That we're not just saying, okay, well, we'll let a couple of blacks onto campus, but rather saying, no, we think that we don't want them to be in a position where their views are constantly marginalized just because of demographics. I'm a big believer in the critical mass social science literature. And I think I love when we do these kinds of topics because they don't break neatly down left-right lines. And I like challenging our listeners. If you're skeptical, I would tell you I would tell you to read the literature because I think it is compelling when you look at the literature to see what happens in terms of silencing, what happens in terms of subconscious bias.
Yeah, absolutely. And also read the book White Fragility for more insight as to all that. I just read it. It's great.
No, I agree with that. So Kennedy, in an earlier case, Grutter versus Bollinger, wrote a separate dissent specifically to highlight the fact that he was rejecting the critical mass thesis. Here's what he says. There was a lengthy opinion in which he also joined by Chief Justice Rehnquist that also tore it down. But Kennedy wrote separately to pull that section out and to say the dissenting opinion by the Chief Justice, which I join in full, demonstrates beyond question why the concept of critical mass is a delusion used by, and it was in that case, the Michigan Law School, to mask its attempt to make race an automatic factor in most instances and achieve numerical goals indistinguishable from quotas. So two things on that. Number one, I don't know if Brett Kavanaugh was the clerk at this time. This was 2003, so he might have been, right? The idea of automatically in most instances, like that would never, if you worked for me, you would not be allowed to write that sentence. But also that test, right, to achieve numerical goals indistinguishable from quotas, that's the test that is going to be outlined in some way, is going to be paraphrased and put before the jury here. Anyway, an effort to achieve racial balance, this is Kennedy continuing, among the minorities the school seeks to attract is, by this court's own admission, patently unconstitutional. And then he goes on. So Kennedy rejects the critical mass thesis, but nevertheless allowed UT Austin to consider race as a, quote, plus factor in the Fisher case. And here's why. Here's what he says. He says, this is Kennedy again from the majority opinion in the Fisher case. Considerable deference is owed to a university in defining the intangible characteristics that make for a good student body, like student body diversity, that are central to its identity and its educational mission. Okay, so considerable leeway. Then he says, but when you're considering race, it must be narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling governmental interest. And then he said, and it's narrowly tailored in this case. So in other words, the Fisher case upheld the UTA's policy, but said, hey, look, we're doing this very, very narrowly on grounds that almost always mean we are rejecting these kinds of policies or laws. And that was obviously an open invitation to groups like SFFA to continue litigating, because when you have to prove a counterfactual, right, when you have to prove that you are using the least restrictive means, then that opens up the entire universe of counterfactuals to the other side, right, to say, oh, okay, like Harvard could very easily achieve its diversity goals by just doing X. And what do you think this lawsuit suggests just doing X? Yeah.
Not using race at all. I don't know. What does it say?
No. Because remember, Harvard doesn't have to actually do this. They just have to show that Harvard could do this. And they put something that Harvard would never in a billion years actually do. And that is, oh, well, if they just got rid of the legacy system and stopped admitting, you know, talentless rich white hacks whose daddy gave a wing to the university, then they could do all of this stuff, knowing full well that will never happen.
Oh my God. Now I don't know whose side I'm on, because that sounds like a good idea. They should do that.
They should, but this lawsuit will not force them to do that, right? This lawsuit will force them to stop considering race in the student diversity and personal characteristics section, if successful, but will absolutely in no way prevent them from engaging in legacy set-asides. There's another really pernicious factor here that I want to point out, because this is another area in which the arguments, I think, undermine the decent arguments on the other side of the equation, right? And those decent arguments go like this. So this is sort of the center-right critique of affirmative action.
Am I crazy, though, for thinking we should just pass a law that gets rid of this legacy system? Like, I mean, is that too restrictive? If it's federal money, how about we get rid of the affirmative action in the form of, if you are a talentless hack who had a rich dad or something, then you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, left, right, or center. Pass it the year that my son is applying to Harvard. I don't care. I will take that, right? No, seriously. Like, I 100% agree with you. There is zero chance that SFFA is ever going to bring that lawsuit. SFFA is financed by these people, right? Like, this is a front organization for people who want it back the way it was. So I agree with you. Not going to happen as a result of this lawsuit. And don't be distracted by that, because this is, in fact, one of SFFA's talking points, right? Like, when they go out, they discuss, you know, oh, we're challenging the quota system. This lawsuit does not challenge the legacy system, right? It uses it analogistically, but will not bring that result. So I do want to pay a little bit of attention to what I think of as a critique having merit of affirmative action. And this is a center-right critique. And basically it goes like this. It says, look, when you have defined inequality as stemming from historical prejudice and belonging to a particular group, that causes you to overlook individuals who aren't a member of that group but may share some of those characteristics. And in particular, right, in the education system, you're talking about very, very poor white kids in rural areas who share far more in common with inner city kids attending East St. Louis High School, right, than they do with kids who attend Georgetown Prep, right? And it's not fair to lump all white people together, because there is an overcoming growing up in, you know, rural Alabama with one room schoolhouses that is at least, if not equivalent to what an African-American student who gets a 5 on the AP test at East St. Louis High School goes through, at least is an awful lot closer to that than what, you know, a kid at a rich white prep school goes through. And I think that critique has merit and deserves a voice in the discussion. I don't think it's dispositive, but I think that it deserves a voice in the discussion. I will point out that is, right, so thinking about how you admit white kids who are from disadvantaged socioeconomic backgrounds is part of what Harvard does. And you may have, I think we've talked about this in one of the listener Q&As, but my Harvard Law class was diverse, not only racially, but diverse in a way that no other school I had ever been to was diverse, right? In terms of background. I talked about the kid who applied to the Forestry Service and Harvard Law School and went to the place that let him in, right? Like, I talked about my friend who was a mid-40s West Virginia coal miner. It was a truly diverse learning environment. And that's under attack in this lawsuit, right? So day one of testimony, the plaintiffs put on evidence showing as follows, that to get an acceptance letter from Harvard, if you are Black, Hispanic, Native American, you would get the recruitment letters if your combined SAT score was over 1100. Right. So you would be invited to apply if you were over 1100. To receive such letters under similar circumstances, Asian American men must have a combined score of 1380 and Asian American women a combined score of 1350. Similarly, the plaintiffs said that white students in states where Harvard attendance is sparse, such as Montana and Nevada, would receive a recruitment letter if they scored at least a 1310. But Asian Americans living in such states would still not receive recruiting letters unless they had a score of 1380 or 1350. So Harvard responded, the dean of admissions responded that, disputed some of the evidence and said that its emphasis on white students in America's less populated regions represented efforts, quote, to break the cycle and persuade students who would ordinarily not think about applying to Harvard to consider going to Harvard. And not only do I think that that is a perfectly legitimate thing for a school to do, but I would point out that's what white people have been asking Harvard to do for several decades.
Yeah, but right? Only with that white is, people.
Yeah.
I mean, cynically, I'm not crazy, right? The whole point of this is they win this lawsuit and then Harvard becomes 40% Asian people and then 58% white people, right? Isn't that the goal, essentially?
And I don't even know that it would, get up to 40%. But yes, the goal of this is to prevent the use, even in a very limited way, of race as a background as part of the application process. Yes, absolutely. And so
they're hiding behind like another demographic group to kind of make the point. It's the equivalent of the prosecutor the Congress hired to ask the questions of Kavanaugh.
It is. And look, the goal here isn't Harvard, right? Just like the goal here isn't Asian Americans. The goal here is the University of Georgia, the University of Alabama. The goal is for those schools to be able to be all white and there to be nothing that you can do about it.
Right. Yeah.
Right. That's where we're headed with respect to this, because we know at those colleges and universities that it would not survive in the current form. It would not survive with the current demographics of the admissions of the student body without some attention being paid to the composition of the student body, without some notice of the factors. And the idea that understanding someone's racial background does not give you insight into that person as a student is mind-boggling to me. And on the flip side, like, let's remember the focus on test scores. We've talked about this before too, right? The original Princeton Review critique of test scores and, in terms of their racial bias notwithstanding, that we sort of vacillate between this notion that, test scores are an objective way to measure academic performance. And we know that that is not the case, right? Assume that you've got no subjective bias in the College Board writing these questions. That's a preposterous assumption, but assume that there's no bias in that. I coach high school debate, right? I know what kids, the different I know what kids get to go through in elite prep schools where they spend a year doing nothing but SAT prep, right? Like, it is the fact that the test is knowable and can be coached means that if you're the student of a rich kid in a prep school, you can hire private tutors. This is a multi-billion dollar industry, right? Private supplemental educational companies that do nothing but promise you, you know, we will get you 200 additional points on your SAT score, right? Those resources are exclusively weighted to the top of the socioeconomic spectrum and therefore exclusively weighted towards white people. So yes, if we move to a system that says we want to take out subjectivity, the necessary consequence is going to be skewing upwards whiteness on college campuses. That's just a fact. That's just the way it will be.
Okay, well, thanks for the breakdown. So it sounds like this is far off. Like, by the time this heads to the Supreme Court, there could be any number of rapists on it. It could be a 3-rapist court or a 4-rapist court. How? What's the next thing we're looking for in this sequence?
Yeah, so this trial is going to take about 3 weeks, which is going to, thankfully, take it past Election Day, but soon thereafter. And we're looking for the jury's verdict here first, because what the jury says is absolutely going to be a signal to other schools as they are considering their policy from year to year. Educational institutions, Harvard may be an exception, but educational institutions are notoriously litigation averse and risk averse. And so if a jury strikes down and, you know, awards attorney's fees, to say nothing of potentially damages, for a plan that, you know, like Harvard's, that allows for discretion in admitting applicants, that's absolutely going to affect how the schools change their admissions policies. And absolutely, they will look at it and say, okay, well, you know, we're going to only use objective metrics at this point. So, you know, it's going to be, that's what I'm looking for. What does the jury find in a couple of weeks?
All right. Thanks for the breakdown. Go check out again, 93, I think you said it was, for more on that really interesting topic. That kind of blew my mind back when we first discussed it, but there you have it.
Okay. Time to do an ad. This week's episode is brought to you by Beachbody On Demand. Beachbody On Demand is an online portal. You get instant access to their streaming service that gives a wide variety of effective workouts that you can do from the comfort of your own home. Here's how it works. You log in. I do it on my phone. You can then select your difficulty level, the amount of time you have for the workout, what you want to do with that workout, right? Slimming, building your core, building muscle, whatever. And then it filters out and you can choose from among the programs. So I've been doing the 10-minute trainer with Tony Horton. I've been doing that because obviously I'm incredibly busy all the time. But you can make 10 minutes a day to work out. And I've been really happy with the program, really happy with the results. So if you've been thinking about losing weight, maybe try it out with me. And as of right now, listeners to Opening Arguments can get a free trial membership. All you have to do is text OA to 303030. So text OA to 303030. You get free access to the entire platform, all of the workouts, the nutrition information. There are cooking guides. There's support. There's online community. There are like a million people online that all participate in the online community. And you can access all of their workout materials and give it a try. So send out text OA to 303030 and try Beachbody On Demand.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay, it is time for some Andrew's Wuzzes. First, which do you want to be wrong or right first? Let's start.
Oh, I'll be wrong first.
Yeah, I think that's good. Get the wrong out of the way. Also, it's probably a more minor thing that, you know, no big deal. And then you can do a victory lap on the Andrew was right.
Yeah, it turns out it's no minor thing. I made an assumption. So, I really, really appreciate. So Tuesday's episode leapt out of my comfort zone a little bit to cover the UK Supreme Court decision in the Asher's Bakery Company case. We try and get to some international stuff. Obviously, there's a higher chance that I'm going to get something wrong there because I'm a U.S. lawyer. And please, please, please do send us emails, corrections, tweets, that sort of thing. I love doing that. I mean, I don't love being wrong, but but if I'm going to opine on international law and I'm going to make assumptions, I want to be told when I'm wrong. And here's the assumption that I made, right? This is the highest court of the United Kingdom. And I assumed that, like our Supreme Court, it was therefore supreme. It was law of the land of the United Kingdom. Turns out not the case. When you appeal a decision from Northern Ireland,
oh, it goes to the
UK,
Queen. Oh.
Yeah. I love that idea. That first it goes through the House of Lords and then that the jurisdiction is only binding in the jurisdiction in which it arose, right? So this is the supreme law of Northern Ireland. Yeah, but not the United Kingdom, right? I knew it wasn't going to apply to, you know,
so
to subsidiary.
The equivalent would be like if something in the US started out of the Ninth Circuit and got to the Supreme Court, they made a decision, but it still only applied to the Ninth Circuit, like, states. Is that
to the states in the Ninth Circuit? That's exactly the analogy that's correct here. Yeah. And our Supreme Court, right? Like, one of the reasons why our federal Supreme Court takes cases on cert is conflict among the circuits, right? Is the Ninth Circuit came out yes, the Fourth Circuit came out no.
That's a weird system. So how does one decision then inform the other? So let's say in a different area, the same kind of facts come up. Are they bound by their previous decision at all? Are they? How does that work? Do you know?
So not bound, but persuasive. So it is not the law in Britain, for example. But if the same facts arose, then presumably lower courts would apply the best precedent they could, which would be the Asher's case. But the Supreme Court, in other words, is not bound by its prior precedent and could rule separately. So
that is
so
really
neat.
Weird.
And I should add, I made this crack on Twitter when someone said, not actually binding outside, you know, one of the first people to say it. I said, well, it's kind of weird to have a Supreme Court that's not supreme.
Yeah.
And a bunch of folks chimed in to point out that, like, for example,
as we have pointed out on the show,
right? Yeah. That the New York trial court is called the Supreme Court. I am aware of this because I live in a state in which our state Supreme Court is not called the state Supreme Court. It is called the Court of Appeal.
Yeah.
Which usually indicates an intermediate court, but instead our intermediate appellate court is called the Court of Special Appeals, even though it should be called the Court of All Appeals. So yes, I was aware of that, but this is actually a country's Supreme Court that is not supreme throughout the country. Still weird. But
interesting
I was
little
definitely
side
wrong.
Note, because I was just in the lovely damp, windy, cold weather of Manchester. And I interviewed Emma McClure, a solicitor in the UK for the live SIO that I'm sure people could hear coming out pretty soon. And one thing she said when we were just during like the kind of meet and greet kind of stuff was she mentioned that people in the UK probably could name several U.S. Supreme Court justices, but could not name a single U.K. Supreme Court justice. Like she.
Oh, they
think,
couldn't. They couldn't name their own. That's fantastic.
She thought that because they don't. People don't even pay attention. They don't even care about the Supreme Court there. According to her, I thought that was funny.
Oh, that is super interesting.
And you know, I don't know how much they're appointing sexual abusers and harassers to the court. So maybe that would change. You know, if that happened, maybe then people it would be in
maybe,
the news or something.
But you know, I mean, as we pointed out on the show, it was shocking in a positive light to me that the Asher's Bakery case cited extensively to Masterpiece Cake Shop and discussed, you know, the way in which these kinds of cases are being ruled on around the world in a way that the U.S. Supreme Court is you know, affirmatively deterred, thanks to Antonin Scalia, from discussing international law. So I thought you were going to go with what would not have surprised me at all, which is that the average, you know, Englander can name two or three U.S. Supreme Court justices, but the average American could not name anybody who sits on the U.K. Supreme Court. I would say probably more British citizens can name U.S. Supreme Court justices than U.S. lawyers could name U.K. Supreme Court justices. I know I couldn't have before we did our show. So,
yeah. Well, there you go. Okay, wait. What were you right about, though?
So I was right about, and this is, I'm doing a happy little victory lap here, about the state of Florida. So right after our show came out, the Florida Supreme Court granted the writ of quo warranto against Governor Rick Scott and said that the governor who is elected in the November 2018 general election has the sole authority to fill the vacancies that will be created by the mandatory retirement of those three justices. Governor Scott exceeded his authority by directing the Supreme Court Judicial Nominating Commission to submit its nominations to fill those vacancies by November 10th, 2018. There will be a follow-up hearing on Thursday, November 8th. I will be paying attention to that, in which, because the JNC is a separate body, in which when that nominating committee can fill those vacancies, but that we will not have a constitutional crisis of nine people in robes bumping into each other sit in three chairs. Yep.
Huh. I thought you had been more, but so that's what you predict. I thought you were a little more pessimistic, is my memory, but I could be wrong on that.
I thought I was pretty positive, but we could put this in.
Well,
an
I'm going to collude
category
with the OA Wiki Squad to make sure that you don't get credit for this. Andrew was right, and then reduce your score by one. no, that's good though. So good news. You don't think there's going to be any? Is this the end of it? We're done with
this
that.
It went straight to the Florida Supreme Court. That was their ruling. Good. It is done and done. And if Rick Scott tried to appoint somebody, then, you know, marshals could come and prevent him from doing so. And I'm serious. I think I'm serious about that, right? Like, this is a writ of quo warranto that says it's beyond his authority, and therefore you could go and get a writ of mandamus to make him do or not do something because he has no discretion. So, so that's over. Court packing in Florida, not going to happen. Ugh. So if you are an OA listener in Florida, get out and vote for Andrew Gillum, the Democratic candidate for governor in your state. Unless, you know, you like this sort of thing, in which case, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Also, the Pod Save America HBO show was in Florida last week, and they talked about the ballot measure to restore, I think, somewhat restore the right to vote for felons. So some good stuff, some good reasons to get out and vote everywhere, but especially in Florida right now. So yeah, vote everybody. And now it's time to thank our top patrons over on patreon.com/law. Thank you so much. We hope you're enjoying all the goodies. Ooh, side note, this is hot off the presses. We may be looking to try to do some better formatting and maybe possibly a better venue for our monthly Q&A. I'm looking into that, being as I'm in charge of anything involving technology greater than a slide rule. Andrew handles slide rule and lower technology. I handle graphing calculator and higher technology.
If there is not an Abacus patron name next week, I will be really, really disappointed. Anyway,
so that's just remind me of it. I want to make that a little easier for people to follow. We might be able to improve the Q&A experience by using, you know, a better streaming thingy. So I'm going to try to do that. And no promises, but that I'm going to try. We're always looking to make things better for our fine patrons. And they are our top patrons for this week include Burbank Makerspace will print anything but guns. Please vote. Vote, 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 vote. That's awesome. That could have been me who did that pledge. No, I don't think it was. Self-Pity on a Hill. End Judicial Review. Ryan, I Only Had a Few Beers. Null. Blank Boxman. Rebecca Bernays. He's not the Messiah. He's a Cavanaughty boy. LiveBaseballScorecards.com. Kurt Robinson. Californians vote no on six. Stop National GOP's attack on road and transit funds. Thank you for the note. We are trying to sift through our California ballot right now, actually. Kiowa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Oh, that still sounds delicious. Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. Don't pardon me, I'll pardon myself. U.S. elections have worldwide consequences. Go vote. Some of us can't. I like beer. I like beer. I don't know if you do. Sam Buck, Milo Mead song, the Halfling Bard, and SIU3L. The other Michael Cohen. Getting off podcast. Join your labor union. Together we borrow. Join your labor union. Together we bargain. Alone we beg. Plastic guns are real. John Malkovich used one to shoot Clint Eastwood. Second Amendment solutions to Article 3 problem / S. I don't know what that cut off, I guess, or something. Sorry, Decisis from the top rope, brother. Somehow we'll all get through this together. Mike the Intactivist, it's too late to run. A skeleton is already inside you. Expectro Patreon. Oh, Patreon. Yeah, Patreonum. Oh, I like it. It's Expectro Patronum, but with Patreon in there. Rob Shrek, Brian Upshaw's last chance for profit prison. Register to vote now, today, and tell your friends. Dalen Lee, Samus Grix, Japan Dan, Buttercup's Law Cat Services. Call 831-CAT-LAW-1 to talk to a law cat today. Anonymous,
if you have called Cat Law 1, write in. Tell us about it.
Oh, I should call him and record it and pop it in. Beer. I like beer. Me likey beer, drink beer. Current Supreme Court Justice quote. That's a quote. Attorney doll relationship. City on fire. Rats in the grass. It's the end of the world. Yes, city on fire. Still a great Sweeney Todd reference there. Use code OA at Hedonist Cake Shop on your first order. Still celebrating the engagement. At this point. No, okay. We'll give it one more week. One more week of celebrating. Then you got to, you know. Right? I mean, eventually
yeah,
you got
to. No, eventually, you got to move forward to step two on that, brother.
Yeah, exactly. Squint finger. If Jimmy Carter could win Texas, so can Beto. Yeehaw. Wow. Wigged hitch runt. And adulterate a dark and stormy with Stormy's peak Avenatti boy dark runt. That's a mouthful. Thank you, guys.
All right. And thank you, too. Go to Vote Save America, votesaveamerica.com. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from the 13th century Saxony. Turd Ferguson, yeah, long live Turd Ferguson. Opening Arguments official position is that Ozzy Osbourne is grunge. That is, again, we are being grotesquely misrepresented, but that's fine. Jeremiah is still ecstatic the Brewers won their division. Hey, you should be continuing excited there, Jeremiah. They look like they're headed to the World Series. Corruptus obfuscatio, an ancient, no, a modern U.S. Republican philosopher. Kelly Green, wedding gown white, and Fort Knox gold. Oh, good on you, Kelly. Early voting starts October 22nd. Let's clownhorn Ted Cruz. Vote Beto. Yep. Saul, big easy blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters. The TTTBE co-ed cheer squad, less sexy but enthusiastic as hell. Legalize the purge. This unpopulated void in Denver is getting awfully crowded. Look, I was not referring to Colorado as an unpopulated void state. That was like Wyoming. And anyway, Brandon Smith, I'm going to let you finish, Andrew, but we all know GoBots was the best robot. Yeah. Brett Kavanaugh is a lying rapist alcoholic who lies, rapes, and drinks. Rhonda, the rigged witch hunter. Malika Chandler. Tony Hawk Vice, which that's pretty clever. Drumpster firefighter. Soggy pants. CampQuest.org. Sam Danow. Greg Sullivan. Zombie James Dio. Yodel Mountain Herb Company, featuring Clown Horn Kush. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Matthew Vernon. Aaron Grady. My law dog is pro bones, yo. Ian and Allie. Thank you. Saint Muller, patron saint of yodelers. Sack of Clownhorn. Clownhorn, sue me. Oh, that's Sakashite. Nice. Good one. Jim Grove. Eli Bosnick. Cooking Heath with ramen. Mitchell, there should definitely be a medium place. Wieners, tweeners, and antihistaminers LLP. All right. I gave you some trouble over the last one. That was pretty good. Michael Rops, Mormon J. Fox, and our all-time great. I don't know that I even need to say it. Everybody knows our all-time great, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Ah, so great. Okay, now it's time. And Andrew, could you remind me what my score is on this thing? I have no idea. I can't keep track of it. What?
Yeah, it's possible you've been teasing this throughout this episode. But no, as it turns out, there was a miscalculation at some point in prehistory, and Teresa Gomez and the OA Wiki folks dug through and discovered that you, in fact, got an extra question right that I was not giving you credit for. And so you are, as of right now, 58 for 97. There are three questions left, and you, before 100. Oh, I should add, so a couple people have been saying, oh, I don't know what you're going to do when TTTB ends. Yeah, we got 100 That's more
not
of
even, Don't you have to take like 250? Like, we're not even close to.
Yeah, you have to take 200. So
200, okay.
But you want to be benchmarking, right? It's a midterm.
But I'm going to be in a permanent state of bar exam purgatory. It's not as though I'm only taking 200. I mean, I assume we'll just keep going with this thing.
Yeah, you apparently wished on a monkey's paw at some point, and now you get to answer bar exam questions
my
for
wish
all
was
eternity.
Like, I wish I could be able to answer bar exam questions, and then the side effect, the evil side effect, was that it's only on TTTBE forever. I can never
for
I'm stuck
ever.
Here forever.
This is going to be great because 50 years from now, I'm going to have, because I'll be dead, but my zombie corpse will be asking you questions. You're going to be like running triathlons, but it'll be fantastic. It'll be Thomas takes the bar exam question number 11,906. But no, so we're ready for Thomas
All
takes
right.
the bar exam
and
question number
And I just have to say, I mean, I know we don't pick favorites between the Team Wiki and the Mod Squad, but I don't know. One of those teams got me an extra point on the bars. So I'm just saying. I'm just pointing out facts. Just reporting.
One of those tapes made me look like an idiot on the show that I co-host. So you know.
So both positive things. Is that what you're saying? Two
yeah,
positive
right.
points.
All right. Here's the question. A city zoning ordinance requires that anyone who proposes to operate a group home obtain a special use permit from the city zoning board. The zoning ordinance defines a group home as a residence in which four or more unrelated adults reside. Mm. An individual applied for a special use permit to operate a group home for convicts during their transition from serving prison sentences to their release on parole. Although the proposed group home met all of the requirements for the special use permit, the zoning board denied the individual's application because of the nature of the proposed use. The individual sued the zoning board seeking declaratory and injunctive relief on constitutional grounds. Which of the following best states the appropriate burden of persuasion in this action?
Mm, tricky.
A, yeah, it is. Because housing is a fundamental right, the zoning board must demonstrate that denial of the permit is necessary to serve a compelling state interest.
Okay.
B, because the zoning board's action has the effect of discriminating against a quasi-suspect class in regards to basic subsistence right, the zoning board must demonstrate that the denial of the permit is substantially related to an important state interest. C, because the zoning board's action invidiously discriminates against a suspect class, the zoning board must demonstrate that the denial of the permit is necessary to serve a compelling state interest.
Hmm.
Or D, because the zoning board's action is in the nature of an economic or social welfare regulation, the individual seeking the permit must demonstrate that denial of the permit is not rationally related to a legitimate state interest. So there you go.
Holy moly. You saved the hard ones for a while. I think this is your revenge. You're like, oh, you got an extra question right. Well, I'll throw this one at you. Well, I was hoping...
Or it was next in the book, but one of those two was
one of those two. I was hoping there would be an answer that was like, it doesn't seem right that you could have a law that bans four unrelated people or requires a permit for four unrelated people to live together. That seems really weird. Like, it's just defining a group home as a resident. Like, so if you, I mean, in college, there are plenty of people who rented houses, you know, four roommates, they would have to get a, that seems invasive to me. So I thought there was going to be one that was based on that, but from the answers, it doesn't really seem like that, with the exception of A, which is because housing is a fundamental right. But I also don't know that that's constitutional language exactly. I don't know if it's spelled out that way in the Constitution. The zoning board must demonstrate the denial of the permit is necessary to serve a compelling state interest. So that does sound like a good answer. Like everything about that seems logical, but I don't know if like strictly constitutionally that makes sense. All right. So B, because hold on, demonstrating. So the other in my issue spotting, the other thing it brings in is a quasi suspect class, which I assume is referring to convicts. And it says during their transition from serving prison sentences to their release on parole. That's interesting. All right. The only one that I think is totally wrong seems to be D, because the zoning board's action is in the nature of an economic or social welfare regulation. The individual seeking a permit must demonstrate that the denial of the permit is not rationally related to a legitimate state interest. That I don't see that anywhere in the question. Like, it doesn't even say why they denied it. They just said, ah, we deny it. So it's that doesn't seem to be right. So I'm definitely eliminating D. And then, okay, so B, because the zoning board has action as if... Okay, so quasi-suspect class seems possibly reasonable. And then C, because the zoning board's action invidiously discriminates against the suspect class. This is a hard one. The zoning board must demonstrate that denial of the permit is necessary to serve a compelling state interest. All right. I'm going to hope they're trying to trip me up with B and C. Now, it could be that I need to know specific wording like suspect class versus quasi-suspect class. I'm just going to hope that B and C are kind of saying the similar thing and therefore they're both wrong in favor of A. I hope A is right. You know, I might be, I'm glad I have one to give because this is a hard question, but A just seems the most overall rational to me. I mean, housing, it seems pretty, I don't know what the word invasive, I think I said earlier, to be able to just like tell four unrelated people they can't live in a house together. So it seems like you would need a strong state interest for that. So I'll hope that it's A, and it's definitely not D, and B and C kind of seem so similar that I couldn't really tell you. I have no information as to which one's better. So that's A, final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media, include the hashtag TTTB, include your guess and your reasons therefore, and we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed, although the results lately have led one to believe that maybe they would be.
Oh, I need to say, I met the person who whose dog won TTTBE. At QED. I was amazed to meet them. It was super cool. I keep it up. Everybody, I think they had a picture of like the dog. They were going to also post the dog on the computer, like posting the tweet, which I wish they would have done. So, that was awesome. Glad I met that person, and keep it up with your TTTBE animal related fun answers, because that's the way to Andrew's heart, and he picks the winner. So, all right. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks, Andrew, for the breakdown. Of course, thanks most of all to our fine patrons who make the show happen, and we will see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
Brian will just have to... deal with this really awkward silence and sexual tension you could cut with a knife. Oh my god, I didn't know what the whole thing was about hookers and flapjacks. Flapjacks and hookers. Everybody kept typing flapjacks and hookers, and I was like, I didn't even remember. Like, I probably just didn't catch whatever that was. And then, so you just had misremembered the quote.
The first time I always thought it was with flapjack with flapjacks and hookers.
Yeah, Bender is known for his love of flapjacks. That's a major plot point for Futurama. That's so awesome. Oh man. I don't blame you for it at all. It's just really funny. Flapjacks and hookers. Maybe that's your idea of a good time. You're good with the hookers part, but you just don't like gambling. That's the thing. You're not going to...
Yeah, right. Yeah,
don't gamble. Take the sure bet, which is a flapjack. A nice, tasty, delicious flapjack. There's no risk of financial ruin. Flapjacks.